So my job is not to tell you that you're wrong, but to present you with empirical facts, facts that you can see for yourself and draw that conclusion. That's how you drive synergy in an organization. If your process was designed to fail, is the process not doing what it was intended to do?
Yeah.
So how can I blame the process if it was designed to fail?
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple, to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. I am your host, Keith Norris. Our guest today is Kishan Cupid. Kishan is the CEO of Modern Kaizen, where he works to transform mindsets, build cultures of continuous learning, and unlock organizational potential through Lean Six Sigma. Kishan has years of experience helping companies build strong learning frameworks, streamline operations, and embed sustainable improvement practices. Kishan has helped countless teams move from good intentions to measurable impact. So whether you're facing resistance to change, trying to scale culture in a fast-growing company, or looking to build real muscle around continuous improvement, you're going to want to listen in to what Kishan has to share. Kishan, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Well, thank you guys for having me today.
You bet. You bet. Yeah, it's been a while since we connected a few years ago. So I'm curious to hear what you're up to and catch up on a few things. Where we usually like to start the conversation here on KPI Fireside is your introduction to lean or continuous improvement. I find a lot of folks have this spark, this moment that got them interested in this discipline. You've obviously made a career out of it. Do you recall what it was that got you interested in this originally?
Oh, definitely. Yes. I got really interested in this back in 2003, July the 14th, 2003.
You remember
very
the exact day?
Very unique day on board the USS Kitty Hawk, you know, in the Gulf right there. That's where I first got introduced to it. And like, you guys are going to send me to this training for free and I'm going to learn. No, it can't be real. So that was the day, you know, it's always a day that's been written down. So I love that day.
So what, you were in the Navy?
Yeah, so I was in the Navy on board the USS Kitty Hawk. And we were having this problem. How do we turn aircraft around, you know, in an efficient manner so we can get them back up in the air? You know, gassing, changing tires if need be, loading ordnance. Now, I was a junior airman, I should say, right? So I was that guy just collecting data. So we had some consultants there and, you know, we were looking at them and I was just trying to understand, well, how can we use just data to make these big decisions? So it kind of drew me in. And from that day, I've never stopped, right? We were able to streamline some operations on an aircraft carrier. My first project ever.
What was that project exactly?
Well, the project was to reduce the turnaround time of aircrafts from that's in operations to get them back up in the air after they landed.
Wonderful, wonderful. So how long were you?
That project specifically?
Or just your military service?
Well, I got medically retired after 13 years. So once I was medically retired, but I was able to take all the training, you know, that I had in the Navy and definitely go outside and start using it to find jobs in the area around that field.
So did they have like a formal green belt certification program or did the training go by some other name?
We used to call it Airspeed.
Airspeed.
That was a name. I think it was under Navier. It was called Airspeed, but it was mostly focused on theory of constraints. You know, buffer management, we have all the tools. I also got more in depth at an eye level, which is an intermediate level where they work on the equipment. So we were having a lot of bottleneck in the processes. So we had to, you know, incorporate these new methodologies to be able to streamline it at that time, to be honest, it was like learning Russian in a Spanish class. It made zero sense to me, right? It was, you know, the delivery was very mundane. So at that time, it was, you had to learn a lot on your own. I always tell people, I said, my first class in Lean Six Sigma was my black belt. It was the only class that was available. So I walked into a black belt class not knowing what a waist was. It was a very eye-opening class.
You got thrown into the deep end of the pool.
Deep end. And I did it all. So I did a black belt. Then I went to green belt to try to understand what I learned in black belt. Then I went to the yellow belt. And then I did the white belt. I did it reverse because, you know, in the service, you have the class schedule. And those were the only dates. So you have to take advantage of what you could at that time.
Well, I'm going to ask you about a particular process on an aircraft carrier. This is a story that my dad told me from like the early 1970s. He was working on an aircraft carrier as well. And every once in a while, they'd have a plane that would go over the edge and, pilot would crash basically. And sometimes they could get lost at sea. And so apparently one of their processes was, particularly at night, if a plane went over the edge, the guys that were on the deck were supposed to throw their flashlights overboard as quickly as they could. And, you know, sometimes the guys would get lost and sometimes they'd get found. Well, in this particular instance, they were able to save him, rescue him, and he came on and he was really grateful to everybody that had helped rescue him from the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
And what he said is, I'm really thankful for you guys that threw the flashlights, particularly the person that hit me in the head with the flashlight.
That's definitely good. Yeah. Because it's all black at nighttime, especially, right?
Yeah.
It's dark, it's black, it's cold. It's not a good feeling.
Yeah, well, hopefully the technology's improved a little bit since then. All right, well, tell us, after you left your military service, what kind of work did you get into and how did you stay involved in Lean?
So I'll tell you this, and it's pretty funny. Once I left the Navy, I decided to open up restaurants. Someone told me that I'm a great cook. So I decided to just, yeah, let's go ahead and do it, right? You know? I can make it work. I'm a lean practitioner. I can reduce my operational costs, but no, that was a lie. You know, it was not gonna work. I forgot that you need marketing. You need, you know, people to work, and it's such a unique environment in the restaurant business. If you have never done it, it's that. Yeah, you get your operational costs down, but you're not out there marketing, right? You're not. Driving business. So I did that for about a year, and then I got back into corporate America, where I started to work as a quality manager and a CA manager for an organization here in California. So wearing dual hats, quality manager, CA manager, which I don't understand why we're still doing this, but one day I'm like, yeah, it's all about quality. Right, we got to make sure we get the parts, have 100% inspection. The next day, it was continuous improvement. Let's build the quality in the process. So it gave me a newfound respect for both fields, right? And able to see how they can incorporate them together. At the same time, ISO 9001 2015 just came out. So we had to bring three different sites on, get them qualified, certified. And it was just a good feeling, right, to be able to do that. And I continue working there, move over to Fender, did the same job over there at Fender, and decided it's time to branch out on my own. So, you know, back in April the 9th, 2019, I started Modern Kaizen.
Just before COVID, I noticed. Yeah, just before the COVID, shutdown a few months before that, huh?
Yeah.
How did that affect you?
Because we shifted to a lot of virtual training during that time. Now, there were several people who took a chance on us as a business, and I'm in their debt. You know, Roxanne from San Bernardino Community College, John Fox, from Chafee, they took a chance to say, okay, this guy, brand new company, he might be good, but no past experience in this business. Let's give him a chance. And I, you know, it worked out well. So I'm always grateful for those folks. That's it. Let's give it a shot.
Well, I love that. You know, I forget the quote that I'm thinking of exactly, but most improvement means doing something we've never done before.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny, you know, from working at Fender and Dexter and all these other companies, 80% of my clients were all once my colleagues. They have now gone on to lead large organizations. So being able to build that relationship to actually see hands-on what you can do and not focus just on the process, but also have to focus on the mindset of the team members, you know, it's like, okay, come on, Kishan, we want you over here. So it's been worked out fine, you know, working with people who I've actually stood shoulder to shoulders with before.
Excellent. And now your company is Modern Kaizen. And tell us a little bit about what you do exactly.
So Modern Kaizen started off as a consulting company, strictly Lean Six Sigma. That was our focus. Our bread and butter was Lean Six Sigma. But we have now grown into a full-fledged company that we serve the entire structure of the organization. And what I mean by that is we look at organization as a system. All right, I'll give you an example. If I ask you right now, which one is more important? The fuse for your ignition switch or in your car or the engine? Which one is more important? And somebody might say, well, the engine, Kishan, is more expensive. But my answer is the most important one is whichever one is not working.
There you go.
Because if the fuse is not working, it costs $5. It's not going anywhere. If the engine is not working, $4,000. You're not going anywhere. So when we look at the organization, what Modern Kaizen does, we look at an entire organization, right? And we ask ourselves this question. One. Is there a central repository of data? Because we need to be able to understand from the people, the process, the products, and the culture, where is that missing link, right? What is disconnected from their system? So we start with the personnel. We focus on from a mindset shift. They have to be able to understand why am I here and how do I fit into the bigger picture? The process, I always tell people, the tools and stuff is very simple. We look at the process and we answer the question. Can your process deliver what you are promising your customers? And if you say yes, can you deliver it repeatable? Can you repeat it over and over again? Then we look at the culture of the organization. We look at the entire culture and see, okay, where are the disconnects within the departments? Right? Because sometimes sales could say, we're doing a great job. Engineering saying operations not good, but what 0 times 100 is still 0. All right. So if you're doing great and they're doing bad, I mean, the organization is not doing well. So we look at the different aspects and we look at the products, right? We help organizations to look at the products and say, okay, we are currently making this product right now. What else can we do? We give you an opportunity to start looking at different innovative ways that we can enhance this product. And now we have shifted, Modern Kaizen have shifted into the artificial intelligence world where we want to have real-time interpretation of data at the 8th grade level. So right now, something I'm very proud of my team that we have created is a system where you can be doing, let's say you're looking up standard deviation. Standard deviation give you the textbook answers. But we want it to be interpreted at an 8th grade level. So organization could continuously feed the data and it comes out and say, yes, this is what you need to do. Right? There's no misinterpretation and everybody understands it.
It sounds like there's some examples of using AI in some of your work recently. I'm curious if you would tell us a little bit about a specific example there.
Yeah, so I give you a perfect example that we're doing right now with a client of ours who does, they do a lot of their work in government contracts. So they bid on government contracts across the United States, and they brought us in to streamline their operation processes. And one of the issues that they were having is that their win rate and performance rate on contracts was below 10%. In other words, yes, they were winning the contracts, but also they had to submit 100 to win 10, but those 10 were doing maybe 2, 3% profits. The one they were losing, they were understanding why they were losing. So what we have done with our AI from, and this is outside of Lean, outside of Six Sigma, another part where we focus on turning complexity into clarity, right, is where we said, okay, well, if you are working on contracts all over the United States have different wage requirements. I drive up the street in California right here, you know, you got to pay different prices. So we have to understand. So our AI, whenever they have a contract, what our software does, it identifies this median wage in that specific area. And we have shifted their focus from making X amount of dollars to percentage in the margins. So now if they go to somewhere like North Carolina, let's say it's $7 an hour minimum wage, and it's $13 an hour they want to be able to charge, but they are based in California. So we cannot use $20 an hour. They need real-time data to say, okay, this is what is being offered within 50-mile radius. And I think I just gave away my entire patent. No problem. Anybody can use it. I want everybody to be successful. So go ahead and use it.
You know, my favorite example there, Kishan, is that so many of us as humans, we know what to do, right? Like whether it's like eating healthy, like we all know we should eat less and exercise more, but how many of us can actually stay on target? Having the information is one piece, figuring out how to use it is another story. So on this podcast, you know, some folks are deep in Lean and some folks are just on the surface here. So when we talk about some of these terms, I like to explain them a bit. Tell us a little bit about what standard work is.
Perfect. So what standard work is the best repeatable way of doing the task. Okay. So in other words, let's say I want to make some eggs. I want to be able to have the different steps that I'm going to continuously follow to be able to do that task.
Yeah. Like, you know, do you cook them for 2 minutes? Do you cook them for 4 minutes?
Exactly.
You know, if you're boiling eggs, do you boil them for 6 minutes or 16 minutes? You get a wildly different outcome. That's very interesting. Okay. So you were just talking about something that sounds not so much like a manufacturing process, but one that's more on sales and marketing. I know that sometimes people think Lean is like just for manufacturing or it came from Toyota. But it sounds to me like you've had exposure into a number of different industries or types of businesses. What are some of the different types of businesses or business processes where you've had the opportunity to apply some of this Lean knowledge and experience?
So I'll give you real examples right now. So today's Monday. I just came back from one of my clients. They build machines that package, like you want to fill up the ketchup bottles, you want to ketchup packets, mustard packets, they build these machines. So it's a packaging machine industry, right? They manufacture it. Tomorrow, I'll be working with a food service business where we are delivering meals, day-to-day meals, 500 plus meals a day. So we want to streamline the operations, right? They deliver meals throughout the city, 500 plus every day, 7 days a week. So today I'm manufacturing. Tomorrow I'm doing food service. Friday I'm working with the hospitals. And also I'm working with the colleges. And then Saturdays we're working with an indoor cannabis grow site right here in California. The largest indoor cannabis grow in California. So different industries, if there is an industry with a repeatable process, it works. And in a given week, I'll work 7 different industries.
Wow. That's gotta be, a bit challenging, but probably also a little bit fun and exciting for you.
Fun and exciting because it allows me to see, no matter what industry you go in, it's the same repeatable problems, the same issues that they're having, right? What?
You've written a couple of books on the topics also, right?
Yes, I have.
Tell us a little bit about those if you want to.
So I get my, what do you call it, a shameless plug, right?
Yeah, here you go, absolutely.
So I've written two books, right? The first one is called Making the Mindset Transition, right? You're going from an inward to an outward mindset. And my second book, well, this one focuses on you, right? Being able to understand from a mindset standpoint, right? Everybody in a company wants to do good. That's my belief. I don't believe you get up in the morning and go to work and say, how can I be the worst employee today? You want to do good. But everyone in their own mind, remember, your mindset is the focal lens through which we view the world and make an interpretation. And that interpretation comes from what? Our education, our culture, our norms, our values, our experiences. So it's not that that person is not a good person or a bad person, it's their mindset. So this is showing you from a mindset standpoint, okay, you want to get ahead, but it's only lonely at the top if you go by yourself. If you bring your team up and be able to shift and work collaboratively. And the second book is all about the synergy mindset. Now that you're operating with an outward mindset, how do I get my team? It says right here, a proven blueprint for leaders who dare to think different.
I love it.
Right? And this, everything in my book, in this book, it's all true case studies, true stories. Now, the names have been changed to protect the identities, but they know who they are. They give me permission to use their name, good or bad. This is personal track of my life and my business, my failures, that you don't need to make these same repeatable failures. All right? And they're all easy read. All right? Actually, when I wrote these books, I wrote them originally for the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs. They hired me to write those books, so... and teach some classes. And it's well-received, all right?
It sounds like there's some very interesting stuff in there. Mindset is always, you know, it's good for everybody in every role, really. And it's one of those things that it's not like you get your mindset right one day and it's just right forever, right? Like we always have to be working on mindset. Are there any stories in there that you want to share with us that would be a glimpse inside of the book?
So I'll give you a story. The best one, not that's inside the book, but something that kind of created the book. And it's a story between my mom. It's about my mom and I. And, you know, while we were going through COVID, as I was writing this, the COVID period, my mother is from the Caribbean. And my mother, she didn't get the vaccine. It's neither here nor there, but it's very important to the story. And I said, she said, I'm not going to get the vaccine because of this. I said, okay. And she said, why did you get the vaccine? I said, I'm a military guy. Just stick me. I got sick so many times. It doesn't matter to me, right? So my mom tried to convince me. And I told my mom a story. I said, Mom, once upon a time in the jungle, there was a donkey. And then there was a tiger. The donkey looked up at the sky and said, wow, that's a pretty green sky. The tiger said, no, the sky is blue. They went back and forth. Then finally, the tiger said, there's a human king, the smartest guy in the world. Let's call him Solomon. Let's go before King Solomon and he will settle this. They went before King Solomon. And King Solomon said, donkey, what color is the sky? And the donkey said, Your Highness, the sky is green. Am I correct? The king said, okay, donkey, if you believe the sky is green, it's good. So he dismissed the case and he said, Tiger, I'm going to sentence you for 3 days in jail. Now the tiger was furious. He said, Your Highness, you're supposed to be the wisest person on the earth. you know the sky is blue. How could you let the donkey go knowing that the sky is green? Tell him that the sky is green. The king said, Tiger, you are the king of the jungle. You know the sky is blue. You spend all day arguing with a jackass. So my mother said, so who is the jackass in the story? Me? I said, I love you, Mom. So from a mindset standpoint, my mom believed what she believed, and I believe what I believe. And without facts, we were just going back and forth. And that's what happens in organizations. When somebody says, oh, I've been here 10 years and it's never going to change. And I said, well, let's look at the facts. And that's what drives it. No, I'm too sure. So that's one of the biggest takeaway from the books. That's actually the cornerstone for the books is understanding that I can tell you that this is a black phone. And you can say, no, Kishan is red. Because you were taught that it was red. So my job is not to tell you that you're wrong, but to present you with empirical facts, facts that you can see for yourself and draw the conclusion. That's how you drive synergy in an organization. I do get passion when I start speaking about this. So
I love it.
I get very animated. So that
I love it. You're a great storyteller. I was definitely drawn in by the tiger versus the donkey. I thought he was going to ask him why he didn't just eat the donkey.
No, my mom always tell that story to this day. But she said, can you believe my son called me that? I said, Mom, I did not. I ended the story.
Okay, yeah. So how do these organizations, you've gone from doing, it sounds like lean, traditional focused consulting to now broadening that into more, I don't know if the right word would be progressive management or just more of a broad spectrum, including some other ideas. Mindset definitely is more of a progressive mindset, you might say. What are some ways that you use that mindset training when you go into these companies?
So first thing first, when I go to the companies, I always ask the leaders, I said, you know, what does good look like? I need to understand from the leadership standpoint, what do you think that good is? Because from your vision as the head of the organization, you have the vision, the mission, you have the, from a, let's say a strategic plan, Hoshin, right? Then you have the company's objectives. So your idea of what good look like, this is what we need to get everyone to agree to be able to go towards that. So when every company that I go to, we always start off with mindset and from a synergistic standpoint to drive system thinking. All right. The lean, the Six Sigma, the belts, I love those. There's very few that I think when it comes, Mark Rogers, you guys got to find him. Mark Rogers, PhD. He's a professor out of Rutgers and Columbia. I probably believe he is one of the guys that when it comes to lean and Six Sigma, hands down. All right. So, but when I go into there, these tools, that's the easy part. The hard part, because I just don't want to go in there and give somebody a belt certification and then come back 6 months and it collapsed, right? It's not good. So we want to go in there. We always start with a mindset. Understand from the team perspective. These are for companies that are employee driven. I have companies that 5 employees, and it's strictly automation. Now, that's different, right? That's no Six Sigma. So we go in there and look at that. But from a people standpoint, once we get the mindset up and running, and I always tell them this right here, and maybe you might agree with me. I said, in the world of Lean and Six Sigma, there's one class. It's called Lean Manufacturing. It's about 8 to 16 hours, all right? Lean manufacturing, 8 to 16 hours, that tells you how to implement lean. Identify waste, what is value, what are the principles of lean. Then we have about 280 hours of belt class that we teach you because you didn't pay attention in the 8-hour class. It's true. Everything else is problem solving at some level. All belts are problem solving class. Yellow belt, the make is problem solving, right? So I always, that's why the mindset is so important. problem prevention. It's where the new ISO standard is going to 9001:2026. How do we prevent problem? Right? A lot of people don't realize CAPA, corrective action, preventive action. We forget the P. Right? So I want to be able to go into organization from a cost of quality stand, cost of poor quality. So once I'm finished with the mindset, my goal is for the leadership to understand what is cost of poor quality. And we break it up into two ways, right? We always break this up into two ways. There is a cost that the company pay for having bad quality. But there's also a cost that we pay for preventing poor quality. So we always look and we say, well, we are paying this money regardless. Here is this new equipment, it costs. Here is this inspection, it costs. So we have to be able to understand, how do I make my system to have built-in pokeyokes that can detect a problem or prevent a problem automatically so it can't move forward? So once I hit those two ways, then we do gap analysis and decide which way we want to go with the business.
Explain gap analysis.
Perfect. Let me go back one. So from a gap analysis standpoint, we always ask, what is a problem? When I do my classes, I said, what is a problem? Give me the definition of a problem. And I've heard from a lot of different people their own definition. And I said, a problem is the difference between what should be happening and what is actually happening. And then I said, what should be happening? Okay, well, tell me, what is happening? That difference is called a gap. The gap is equal problem. So a lot of times we try to solve the current state, but we need to solve the gap. So when we do a gap analysis, we are looking at standard. What is the standard? What is the requirements? And how far are we from these requirements? But there's something we also look into a gap analysis. Are these standards even relevant? So we look at it from that aspect too. Right? Why are we doing these standards? So
would be an example where the standard isn't relevant?
Oh, yes. 100% inspection. Why do we have 100% inspection? This is my theory. This is just my opinion. Previous listeners, do not send me an email. That's okay. Send me an email.
Yeah, please send me an email.
I'll give you an example, right? Unless the customer is paying you for 100% inspection, you should never have a process with 100% inspection, all right? So a lot of times, if you look at an 8D, 8 discipline, right? In D1, D2, D3, D3 is all about immediate control, stop the bleeding. So how do you stop a bleeding in production when manufacturing? You put 100% inspection on it. And we never remove those inspectors because we get busy, we move on to another project, and we never move forward with discipline 4, which is root cause analysis, right? And so forth.
Okay. You dropped another term on us, the 8 Ds. I want to ask you to explain that.
Oh, yes. So the 8 Ds stand for 8 disciplines. It's a methodology. I almost got in trouble. It's a tool that we use, right? It's a tool that is made up, just like how Lean Six Sigma is comprised of Lean and Six Sigma. The 8D is made up of different, it takes the best from other problem-solving methodologies and put together these great tools that follows eight systematic steps that must be followed in order to problem solve. For example, you have D1, discipline 1, and I love how they call it discipline because you have to follow it, right? So discipline 1, you know, it's all about, you know, getting that team. Discipline 2, right? You know, we understand the problem. And discipline 3, you know, stop the bleeding. Discipline 4, root cause analysis. All the way to discipline 8, where we reward the team. It's one of the great tools out there if used correctly. And it's one of the worst tools because we tend to jump from discipline 2 to discipline 8. We jump around.
So, Kishan, you mentioned that you're working across a number of different industries. Are you seeing some common patterns or some common problems to solve in these different industries that are worth going into a little bit?
Yeah. So one of the core problem that we see among all industry is work instruction, standard operating procedures, or standardized work or standard work. In other words, the documents that tells you how to do the jobs are only open when there's an inspection or audit. That's what, that's the number one problem I'm seeing across these industries. The team are not familiar with the standard operating procedure. They know it's there, but they have learned to do the job from someone. And they learn all those bad habits. And then they teach somebody else their bad habits. And no one ever look inside the work instruction.
How do you address that when you go into an organization from a mindset perspective? How do you get folks to pay attention to that thing that they think they don't need to pay attention to anymore?
So this is where I put a lot of you know, emphasis on the supervisors and the team leaders. I truly believe you're not going to be able to sit down and read the standard operating procedure every day. But you create standardized work from these instructions. And I'm a firm believer in the pencil. You write your standardized work in pencil as a team leader, and you have to make sure that you review the standardized work every month for improvement. Should be no more than 30 days. But there's a tool that's called the Layered Process Audit, LPAs. And what the Layered Process Audit does, it allows for management to come to the floor to audit the process using the standard works or the standardized work. So that, and they're able to see in real time, is the team following this, right? But also, from a mindset stuff, I always have the team to also be engaged, especially if you have, you know, dashboards and stuff like that. Now, I have a love-hate relationship with, you know, dashboards in terms of, I'm not a fan of the fancy print-off boards. A pencil, write it on the board. Have the team members, not the leadership, the team members update the board because the board is for them. So they have that insight. They can see that every day. And they can see, okay, do I have a straight line across? And I love straight lines. That tells me the process is in control. We are very predictable. I don't like to see this.
One of my personal soapboxes, I guess, I like to get on periodically, is that ownership at the production level of individuals owning their productivity. Are there any examples? You mentioned the love-hate relationship of over-automating or too much technology, too much digital versus letting people own their metrics.
Right. Let me just clarify that. When it comes to the software, that's for the leadership. Perfect. On the shop floor, at the point of use, that's where I want the ownership from the team members to be in. That's where they need to be able to write it on the board, write their numbers, you know, draw their graphs, draw their charts at the shop floor. Because what happens, and I saw this when I was a CI manager, is that when I did the presentations for the leadership, it was good, it worked. But every morning, the shop floor was waiting on me to print out the graphs and the charts. And if my team is late, then the information is late. And they never learn how to do it themselves. So that ownership kind of slacked, right?
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com.
So you mentioned a job there, CI manager. And again, the people listening to this podcast are in different organizations with different kinds of structures. How would you describe the typical job of a CI manager?
Ooh, I love that. That's a great key. That's a good question. What is the job of a CI manager? The job of a CI, and I've been in this job for a long time. All right. The job of a CI manager is, one, to be an educator. In other words, making sure the team understands at the most basic level. For example, identifying lean waste. All right. And so that's one. Number two, here's get very important. The CI manager, their main job is a translator. And what I mean by that is they take company objectives and translate them into actions, tactical actions with the team. And then they take those action, those results, and translate them back into KPIs for the leadership team to look at. So as a CI manager, you have to be well-versed and with the shop floor. So I've seen CI managers having a meeting on the shop floor and they break out a block plot and they start talking, break out a scatter plot and they start showing on the screen, here's the scatter plot. You can see the correlation. And I'm like, I don't think nobody know what we're looking at here. So they're very smart. I mean, they know the process, but we have to translate. All right. Because not everybody... one great thing that you have been doing is saying, hey, what is that? Explain that for the listeners, right? Yeah. So it's the same concept.
I think that's it. I love that definition of to work as a translator, because take something as simple as a control chart. Creating a control chart is not a simple thing to do necessarily, but looking at a control chart and visually seeing if you're in like the red, yellow, or green and being able to interpret it, that's a pretty easy thing to do. I find most people can, like, once you explain to them what's going on there, like, yeah, it's a simple visual device. I love that explanation of the CI role as a translator. That's very good.
Let me ask you something, right? Based off your experience and the folks that you have talked to, what is a control chart? Because I've been to so many companies and everybody has their own version of a control chart. And they say, oh, Keyshawn, this is what we call a control chart. And, you know, sometimes I always add, like when I was at Fender, I used to say, we Fenderized it.
You know what? That's a really good lesson right there, because that's probably one of my best insights in working with a lot of different companies over my experience. Is that there's never like one way of doing something. There's always so many ways and a local interpretation, even if it's like, you know, well, this is how Toyota did it, or this is how somebody else did it. There's always a different time and a different place and a little bit of subjectivity. And so being able to explain what it means here in our company or your company is always such an important part of the understanding, the communication process.
You hit it right on the head. Because, you know, as consultants, you know, as business developers, the one thing that I get a lot of my people, my field, including myself, get wrong sometimes is going into a company and say, that's not correct.
Yeah.
But we have to understand that there's different input variables, independent variables, that is causing that tool to be used that way. All right. And, you know, for example, I'll give you a perfect example here. Like, I used to see people when they did their corrective action, they do the corrective action report and quality, and they said, we're going to untrain employee was the root cause. And I will honestly said, we have a bigger problem than untrained employees, because what you just told your customer is that your process allows untrained employees to touch their product. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right? Or they'll say, we're going to retrain the employees. Again, what did we just tell the customer? That my training process is not good.
Yeah.
So these are the kind of stuff that we look at, right? You know, and I was watching a video the other day, and the gentleman said, you know, and It's probably in all the lean books. Don't blame the people, blame the process. But I want to add to that. If your process was designed to fail, is the process not doing what it was intended to do? So how can I blame the process if it was designed to fail?
I think that's a very, I would describe that as an empowering mindset. If you're responsible for setting up the process, working in the process, I agree with you that I think most people come to work wanting to do a good job. If somebody's not doing a good job, you know, I mean, there's some exceptions certainly, but I think on everybody's first day of the job, they all want to do a good job. And when you take that mindset, perhaps it can be empowering, I think, because it's, you know, like you can always fix a process, you know, sometimes changing somebody's nature, not so much, but there's always some improvements to be made when you think about the process.
Yeah. Years ago, a mentor of mine gave me this with words of wisdom. He said, the most dangerous employee is an overmotivated employee. And he said, Keyshawn, that employee wants to do good. And they are going to do good by any means necessary if you do not have structure. So even though in their mind, from their mindset, they're doing good, but they might be causing irreparable harm to the business. And how do you go and tell an employee who's the go charger, who's the shining star, that they are wrong? And he said, that's why you have to have structure. It's a coloring book. Here are the lines that you can't color out of. And I always take that with me. You know, I've been very fortunate in this business. You know, I always tell my wife, I said, my goal in life is to meet the world's luckiest man. Because I want to meet that person because I've been lucky, right? I've been lucky. I've been good, been successful in this field. I have a lot of great friends and clients and associates and doing something that we love to do. To improve. And if somebody out there who's doing something luckier than that, I want to meet them.
That's what I love. I love it. I love talking to people like yourself, Keyshawn, who are really enthused about what you're doing and feel like it's, you know, it's a good place to put your energies and, you know, earning a living and making things better. I appreciate that. I can see that with you definitely in your enthusiasm. It's really, really excellent.
Thank you. Oh, definitely. I really appreciate it.
I got a question for you on the topic of an overmotivated employee. Sometimes people get, let's say, the goal and the metric mixed up. Sometimes in pursuit of the wrong number, the wrong metric, people can have bad behavior. I'm curious if there's a story or a situation that you've seen where using the wrong metric or the wrong target led to bad behavior instead of, you know, better results.
Have you ever built an IKEA furniture?
Yeah.
Have you realized that halfway through or when you finish, you missed a step or a little slanted?
I have extra
parts. Do you
parts.
Say, I'll make it work? Or do you go back and take it apart and do it over? Because I don't go back and take it over. Now, let's take that and put that into the work center. You might have somebody that says, man, my metric. Our KPIs, our on-time delivery is down. We got to get it up, right? That's their primary metrics. So what are they going to do to drive that metric up? Well, we're going to work faster and we're going to work overtime. So the metric that they're going towards, the metric to get the parts out, but nobody's paying attention that we are sending bad products out. We are cutting corners to get the products out to meet that metric. And then we are burning overtime. So we are going back and we are celebrating. Look at the on-time delivery. And then finance is just pulling their hair out. They're just going crazy. Finance is like, yes, but you just spend twice as much in overtime. And look at all the return material authorizations that are in the inbox for bad parts that are coming back. So that's an example where you have that metrics that's being driven because you are solely focused on that one metric and you want to achieve that green. And we don't realize that we are compromising everything. I can tell you a quick story about when I was at Fender. So at Fender, we had different processes from where we sand the guitars at the first process to where we buff and polish it towards the end. I had an employee came to me, he said, "Keyshawn, I love what we are doing, but I have a way that we can reduce the amount of time by sanding the guitars with coarser sandpaper. We can take off more and the quicker." So I was like, "Whoa, this is great. Do it." So we did an experiment. We had about 100 guitar bodies. And I'm thinking to myself, Fender's been around since the 50s. Nobody thought of this. Keyshawn is the best. My team is number one. So we send these guitars down because I'm trying to get the metrics, trying to get more products out. The guitars were painted, but guess what happened when they buff and polish? All those scratches came to life deep inside the guitars. 100+ guitars. And you can't take off any more wood. So here am I like, okay, this is embarrassing. This is very embarrassing. You know, I thought I was doing a good thing by chasing a metric. I'm not afraid to call myself out when I do this kind of stuff wrong because I was celebrating, I was bragging, I was picturing accolades and, you know, other boys. Nope. Because I was not paying attention that, hey, am I causing problems? Or this company is 60 years old. Did nobody think of this before? Am I that smart? So that's an example. So yeah, I know if the Fender folks are watching this right now, they're probably laughing and they're just like, yep, that's all Keyshawn, he did that.
Yeah, it's probably good to have some best practices, have some record of previous experiments that have been ran too, right? Particularly failed experiments, because I mean, I've seen that in a lot of different businesses where somebody comes up with a new idea and it's a fine line because, you know, the new person will say, "Have we ever thought about doing this?" As they know, we don't do that because this is the way we've always done it. Or maybe we did try it and it didn't work back then. But, you know, particularly nowadays, I mean, AI is just one of those examples where things that weren't really possible or feasible before might be worth taking another look at because things change periodically. Well, Keyshawn, I want to move into a section. We call this the rapid fire. So these are just some kind of quick questions, kind of short answers. The most important job of a leader is to blank.
The most important job of a leader is to listen.
Do you have a favorite go-to problem-solving tool or visual device?
My favorite go-to problem-solving tool is a basic 5Y because it allows me to go to other problem-solving tools.
That's a good place to start for sure. Is there a book that you recommend? Of course, your own, but maybe another one that you want to point out?
If you look behind me, I have it right here. I buy copies of this for my friends and folks. As a Man Think It by James Allen. I always carry these with me. And everybody who works with me has one of these.
I love it. That's great. Appreciate the recommendation.
Cause and effect.
Finish this sentence. Continuous improvement is?
Continuous improvement is never ending.
So true. So true. I have yet to meet the perfectly operating company.
Nope. Yep.
Or the perfect person.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite question?
So my favorite question that I love to ask of any companies or anybody that I work with is, what does good look like to you?
What are you most excited about? What are you fired up about?
I'm fired up about leading change.
Is there something that you believe that others tend to disbelieve?
What I believe that a lot of people tend to disbelieve is that everybody shows up to work wanting to do good.
Excellent. Is there a prediction about the future of continuous improvement, this discipline, maybe as it relates to AI that you're willing to make?
So my prediction that about in the future when it comes to continuous improvement, that in the next 5 to 10 years, decisions are going to be made solely based off past performance and less subjectivity in the data.
Well, Keyshawn, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure. You've got an excellent energy. I love having a conversation with you. I love your enthusiasm about this discipline. And thanks so much for joining us. So for our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a guest, ask a question, or connect with me, you can find me on LinkedIn. Keyshawn, can folks find you on LinkedIn or on your website?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn, Keyshawn Cupid, website modernkaizen.com. I do respond to every LinkedIn message.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thanks again so much. We appreciate you joining us here. Kishan, and this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to add a comment, send a like, a follow, a message in the comments. You can subscribe on all the socials. You can share the podcast with your friends or colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.